football folk is doing. Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
Hey, as a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFF.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
And you just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam.
So,
who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football. I like football season and all the things that go with it.
Welcome into the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Palazzolo once again flying solo because Sam took another vacation. So it's just me. I'm by myself. I'm taking over the show. I will have a guest, though. Eric Eager from the PFF Forecast will join me talking all things NFL. You don't want to miss that because a lot of the stuff that you guys have heard here on the PFF NFL podcast, stuff like running backs don't matter and defense doesn't matter, I get to the heart of it because Eric, it's his fault. It's his fault that that's what we've discussed. So I ask him about it. We're going to get into what that stuff actually means. So we're going to do that in just a little bit. But first, Sam's out, so I get to go full monologue style again. My offensive line, not mine, it's PFF's. Offensive line rankings are out. So we're going to go through the offensive line rankings, and then we'll wrap it up with Eric of the PFF Forecast. Again, talking all things analytics and findings, but also stuff about the Chiefs, the Rams, the Titans, the Julio trade, Julio Jones going to the Tennessee Titans. I need to give the initial take on it. I said a couple weeks ago, this is the most important move for the Titans this offseason. Full disclosure, by the way, I'm on the wrong side of the table here. Did you guys notice that? Can we get that shot again? I'm on the wrong side. This is very uncomfortable. I'm on the wrong side, and it's because of a camera deal we got here, but I got to be on this side of the I'm on Sam's side of the table. And it's like moving from right tackle to left tackle. It's very uncomfortable. So bear with me, okay? I got my mic adjusting hand is different now. Everything's off. But the Julio Jones signing to the Titans, I mentioned a couple weeks ago, it was the Titans needed Julio more than anybody else. I do fully believe that. I think the Titans were the team a few months ago I was most concerned about, and now I'm far less concerned about them. I know it's a lot of eggs in one basket, and Julio has battled injuries, and he's not a guy that, you know, plays 1,000 snaps every single year, but it was a necessary move. They needed to shore up the secondary. They needed a right tackle. They needed to figure out the playmaker situation, the pass catchers. And they invested in Janoris Jenkins in the secondary. They invested in Caleb Farley. Dylan Raiduns, they're hoping second-round tackle is going to be the starting right tackle there. And then Julio paired with A.J. Brown. I mean, those are the types of things. If you came into the offseason knowing they had to fix those things, that Tennessee had to fix them, and they made the right moves. Okay, so Julio to the Titans, potentially a huge move. We'll talk about it more with Eric. All right, let's get into the offensive line rankings. They're over at pff.com. 1 through 32. It's over 10,000 words of greatness, but I know you're just going to go read about your team. And I tried to give every team some love. Try to talk about all their starters, maybe some of the depth and their backups. This is different. You know, when you're ranking offensive lines, it is different from what I did last week, which was the pass catchers, the receivers and tight ends. When you have receivers and tight ends, there are teams like the Titans before they signed Julio Jones, where you could say A.J. Brown is good enough that this team, even though everybody behind them isn't good, they're not the worst team in the league. This superstar can carry them. Or a team like the Vikings, where it's really two options. Irv Smith's pretty good, but it's two options. It's Adam Thielen. It's Justin Jefferson. And they're a top five caliber team. They have two really good receivers, a pretty good tight end. But wide receiver 3 and 4 is a question mark. There's not really a great backup tight end in there. So when you're ranking pass catchers, you're balancing the stars with the teams that have really good depth, that have a good receiver 3 and 4 and 2 or 3 tight ends to throw to. With an offensive line, the stars matter far less. And it is way more important to, again, be good across the board, right? You don't necessarily need that star left tackle. You need to be solid at every position. Having stars does help. It does make up for deficiencies elsewhere, but not as much as maybe other units. So let's go through. Do we want to start at the top or the bottom? I'm talking to nobody here because it's just me. I'm going to start at the bottom. I'm going to start at the teams that ranked last in our offensive line rankings, and we'll work up to the teams that finish first. And here's how I do this, right? I go through, I write up the team. I write about all the players and what they've done and what we think they're going to do. And then what I do is I throw in a number into a spreadsheet. And it's just this, based off what I think, perception-wise. And this is just how I start. We use numbers to get to these final rankings. But I like to just make an estimate for where I think this team is going to land. So the 32nd offensive line ranking team right now is the New York Giants. And when I put their number in, I was like, they feel like 28. You know, I don't know where they'll end up landing, but they ended up landing dead last in our rankings. And I don't feel great about the Giants being last. I do think there's a path to them getting better. I can see it. But it's just, they have a lot of question marks. Andrew Thomas, the starting left tackle, did struggle last year as a rookie. He got a little bit better down the stretch, but he was a disappointment. We don't know if Nate Solder is even going to be on the team. Nate Solder generally is about a league average tackle. He did have his worst season of his career since his rookie season, the last time we saw him, though, in 2019. Nate Solder is battling at right tackle with Matt Paird, third round, second-year player, who we really liked as a developmental prospect coming out of UConn. I think Matt Paird is going to be a good player. I don't know if he's ready yet. I think the Giants would love for him to be the right tackle. But if you have Matt Paird and Andrew Thomas as your starting tackles, yeah, you've got some questions there. It's not set in stone. Will Hernandez has not been great at left guard. He's disappointed as a second-round pick. Shane Lemieux might be the guy that takes over there. He had a 32 grade last year. It seems like the Giants might want him to be the left guard there. Nick Gates, it was his first year playing center last year. First year. And that was risky. He wasn't great either. 59.7 grade. He should get better, though. That second year playing center. He had never played center. He had never taken a snap or snapped the ball at center in the NFL or in college. And then Zach Fulton comes in. He's a league average guard, battling Kenny Wiggins and Jonathan Harrison and others. So there's nowhere on that Giants offensive line where you just feel great. But in the positive world, you could say Andrew Thomas takes a step forward. Nick Gates takes a step forward. And Nate Solder is on the football team. It's either Solder's on the team or Matt Paird beat him out. And that's probably going to be a league average tackle if one of those two things happens. So you can see this world where the Giants aren't last. But right now on paper, I think they have to be. So the Giants are 32nd in our offensive line rankings. I'm not going to go through every team. Or maybe I will list every team. But you can read it all on PFF.com. We'll go through the teams at the extremes. The Carolina Panthers are number 31. They're a team that has had Russell Okung and Taylor Mouton as their two tackles the last 2 years. Mouton comes back. He's by far their best player. This is that example of A.J. Brown and then a whole bunch of question marks from a Titans perspective before they got Julio. That's the Panthers right now. Mouton, 81.6 grade last year. He's been fantastic. He's been one of the better tackles in the NFL. And he has ranked in the top 20, what is it, top 18 tackle each of the past 3 years. So Mouton, consistent, good. Left tackle. The wild card here is Brady Christensen, their third-round pick. Because Cam Irving right now is slated to be the starter. Cam Irving has only had one career grade above 50 in his career, PFF grade. He was a 58 last year. It was just on 279 snaps. Irving started his career as a center. He was a left tackle and a center at Florida State. If he's the starting left tackle for the Panthers, I think that's, you know, clearly a big weakness. Greg Little, former second-round pick, he hasn't developed as expected. So Brady Christensen, the third-round tackle out of BYU, which was great. Sam mentioned to me, he watched that little Panthers draft room series where they said they had Christensen as a second-round guard and a third-round tackle. So there's a chance they want Christensen to come in and maybe play left guard. But if he could play tackle, 95.9 grade last year at BYU. He's a little bit older. He wasn't challenged a ton at BYU against great pass rushers. But if he's that good and he could play left tackle, that helps the Panthers not be the 31st ranked offensive line. But if he's at tackle, left guard is Pat Elflein. You know, they brought him in free agency. He's like Cam Irving, a history of not grading above 50. Anything below 50 is pretty bad. Elflein has graded at that level pretty consistently his entire career. Matt Paradis at center has had his two worst seasons since coming over to Carolina after four really good years with the Denver Broncos. And then Dennis Daly comes back. He's healthy now, going to play right guard. You played left tackle as a rookie a couple years ago. Another question mark. So it's Mouton and a bunch of question marks for the Panthers. That's why they have to be 31st. All right, Miami Dolphins. They're 30th, right? Because when I'm alone here, I do try to bring the positive, right? I know when Sam's alone, he gives you the fatal flaws, which you guys seem to like. Everybody liked to listen to the fatal flaws episode with Austin Gale when he filled in. But I'm trying to skew positive here. So even these worst offensive lines, I'm trying to give you a reason for them to be even better. How could they be better? How could they rank a little bit higher? But as of right now, we have to put the Dolphins at 30. Here's why. Austin Jackson at left tackle graded a 52 last year, first round pick. You can make some assumptions with offensive linemen getting at least a little bit better year over year, but that is a rough starting point. Matt Skura comes in to play center. He only had a 49 grade last year for the Ravens. He's generally been a 50s, low 60s type of player. So there's no saying Skura is going to be a little bit better. The best rookie that they had last year, they had three rookies, Solomon Kindley and Robert Hunt were the other two. Robert Hunt came in and played right tackle at a good, reasonable level. He was the most promising of the three rookie starters for the Dolphins. If he plays right tackle again, Jesse Davis kicks into guard, fine. But Jesse Davis, again, hasn't really performed all that well for the majority of his career. There's no evidence for him moving forward, other than we do see, you hear me say this all the time, we do see some offensive line jumps in years 3, 4, and 5. So Davis is in that range where he could take that step forward. They'll need that. They need Davis to take a step forward at guard. Robert Hunt, take that step forward at right tackle after a good starting season. Austin Jackson's got to get better at left tackle. Liam Eichenberg comes in from Notre Dame, played tackle there, probably plays at guard for the Dolphins. Nothing there in that list screams, hey, we're good. We're all set. You know, this team's looking good. There's a lot of what ifs. This is exactly how we described the Jets offensive line last year, right? They brought in a ton of talents. They drafted Mekhi Becton, and we said, well, if these four things happen, they might have O-line 15. And those four things didn't happen. But that's where the Dolphins are right now. We've mentioned a ton on this show, too. Don't look at sack totals. They cut down their sacks by about 20 last year, but it's because Fitzpatrick threw the ball faster than ever, and Tua got rid of the ball pretty quickly. Sack totals do not determine how well the offensive line has played. They whiffed on a ton of blocks that didn't necessarily show up. So we're just ranking that offensive line performance. All right, the number 29 team, fourth worst in this ranking, is the Pittsburgh Steelers. All right, the Steelers hate continues on this show. But again, we have to go and say they're replacing 3 out of 5 starters, including Hall of Famer Marquise Pouncey. Where are the Steelers going to get better? They were a mid-tier offensive line last year. Also, when ranking offensive lines, you have to balance pass blocking and run blocking. There are some lines who are really good at one and not at the other. The Steelers were the worst run blocking offensive line in the NFL last year. Run blocking does matter, right? We're going to talk later with Eric about, do running backs matter? Run blocking does matter because that is what is a bigger driver of rushing production. And you don't want to average 3.3 yards per carry. You want to at least be efficient when you are going to choose to run the ball. The Steelers' run blocking has to get better. And their pass blocking took a step back last year as well, with one of the fastest, you know, quickest passing games in the NFL. So they've got Chukwuma Okorafor moving from right tackle to left tackle. It was his first full season last year, 58 grade. He's got to get better at left tackle. Zach Banner has done some nice things in the run game. He can lean on people. He's a monster. He's going to play right tackle. But he's played about 300 snaps in his NFL career since 2017. So we don't know exactly what we're going to get from Zach Banner. And he hasn't been great from a pass protection standpoint. Center, J.C. Hasenauer, battling rookie Kendrick Green, third rounder. We don't know who's going to replace Marquise Pouncey at center. And I think guard is the place where you feel best about the Steelers' offensive line. Kevin Dotson did some nice things as a rookie. David DeCastro has been their best offensive lineman, most consistent lineman over the last few years. However, he's still coming off his worst grade. So when we're ranking offensive lines, it's how many of these guys can we count on going forward? How much information do we have where we could say, he's a check, and just, you know, when we get to the top offensive lines, you'll understand the difference. The Steelers don't have that. They don't have guys that we know we can count on. But Okorafor and Banner, once again, they're in that like 3 to 4 year window in the NFL, 5 year window for Banner, where maybe there could be that improvement. You can see that, but it usually comes with experience that Banner doesn't have. Okorafor just has the 1 year as a starter. We might be 1 year removed from even those guys making that leap from offensive linemen. All right, last bottom tier offensive line I want to break down. It's the Jets at 28. I know they've invested heavily, but there are still questions. We've got Connor McGovern potentially at center with Dan Feeney. McGovern, Feeney's been a below average center, but they did bring him in. McGovern's been an okay center. Mekhi Becton looks really good. As a rookie last year, he had one of the highest percentage of positively graded run blocks in the NFL. He was as advertised from a run game perspective. I will admit we underrated him. I don't regret underrating him, but I will admit the data. What we said about Mekhi Becton coming out was there are questions, right? We didn't see him on those true pass sets. We didn't see him straight up pass protect with no play action, with no rollouts on 5 and 7 step drops. We didn't see it very often at Louisville. And when he did it, the grade wasn't great. Last year, it was much better. He proved it. He worked with our guy Duke over at OL Masterminds. Duke made Mekhi Becton this 365-pounder, got him looking really good. So he had a great rookie season, 74.4 overall grade. Not as good as Tristan Wirfs, but a really good rookie season. And Mekhi Becton absolutely mauls people in the running game. He did have one of the higher percentage of negatively graded plays. He wasn't perfect, but he will create room for their running backs. Then you have Elijah Vera Tucker, the guy that they traded up to get at number 14. They said they had top 10 grade, the Jets, on Vera Tucker. He could be an excellent left guard. I think there's a chance he could battle at right tackle. George Fant is the right tackle there, and this is part of the reason why the Jets have to be ranked lower. George Fant, he's been in the league for a few years now. He's improved since he looked – I mean, he was a basketball player. He played basketball at Western Kentucky and then had to transition to football. He was a young football player. He's gotten better since he just, you know, looked like a basketball player blocking in an NFL game in his rookie season. He's gotten better since that point, but still he's a 61 grade below average tackle last year. So that position needs to get better. Vera Tucker could move to right tackle. I think they want him at guard, though. So let's slot him at left guard. It's Feeney and McGovern at center. That's okay. And the whole right side is just okay. Greg Van Roten, 63 grade last year, mid-tier. From a guard standpoint, I mentioned Fant as a below average right tackle. So they are a team with Morgan Moses still out there, a guy that is coming off of a really good season in Washington, has been released, and I know the Jets have been kicking the tires on Morgan Moses. That changes their prospects really quickly. We're going to re-rank these offensive lines in July. Just adding a Morgan Moses and upgrading over George Fant at right tackle probably moves the Jets potentially into the teens. So I always talk about having, you know, one player doesn't move the needle. It's not a superstar-driven unit, but you have to avoid weaknesses. And right now, I think you would say George Fant is a weakness, and a Morgan Moses at right tackle turns it into a strength. And that is significant when you're looking at that starting five. So the Jets, like these other teams at the bottom, they just have more question marks. All right, let's count down the top five. We'll count down the top five offensive lines, starting with the Tampa Bay Bucks. They're bringing back all their starters. They got incredible play from Tristan Wirfs. He was the best rookie tackle by a wide margin last year, one of the most valuable tackles in the entire NFL last season. So you get Tristan Wirfs. He was an absolute steal at right tackle. Donovan Smith. So this is where all of you fans, when I'm telling you that your offensive line's not good and it's not going to get better, you just throw Donovan Smith right back at me, because he has literally gotten better all 6 years of his career. A better grade from 2015 through 2021, every single season. 72.8 last year. Donovan Smith still has some ugly reps. He still has some games where he's got to yell, "Watch out!" to the quarterback. You get the watch out block. You just whiff, you get the watch out block. Donovan Smith has that, but far less than he used to. So Donovan Smith's gotten better every single year. That becomes a pretty good tackle tandem. And then they're really solid on the interior with Ali Marpet, with Ryan Jensen and Alex Kappa. Added a little bit of depth with Robert Hainsey, the tackle out of Notre Dame. So all five starters are coming back. Ali Marpet's graded in the green. PFF premium stats, you just look at the grades, in the green, right? That's the good side of the grading. You don't want to be, yellow's average, orange and red is bad. Marpet's been a green grade every single year of his career, 80.7 last year. And then Jensen and Kappa, both yellow-green, right? So you're talking, this is one of those teams. You might call Tristan Wirfs a superstar. He's only done it 1 year. You might call him a superstar, but this is one of those teams. Are there any questions across the board there? Not really. Donovan Smith's answered them. And all those interior, the two guards in the center have been good. So it is solid across the board. That is a good offensive line. It's the Bucks at number five. Put the Saints at number four. Now they have, they're built a little bit differently. They have a couple question marks, but their tackles are so good. They ranked fifth in our, they finished eighth in our offensive line rankings in 2020. Fifth in 2019. But they've got the best tackle duo in the NFL. I like these guys the best. Teron Armstead, Ryan Ramczyk. They're both fantastic in pass protection. They both bring power to the run game. And then from a zone run blocking perspective, quickness and technique, they are both excellent players. Teron Armstead, he graded 84.9. He was a top 10 tackle last year. Ramczyk actually took a step back last year. It was his fourth year in the NFL, 79 grade. It was actually the worst grade of his four-year career. 79 grade, he was still a top 20 tackle. His first 3 years in the league, though, were comparable to Joe Thomas, the great Joe Thomas, Hall of Famer. From a grading standpoint, he was right behind Joe Thomas and Jake Long, another guy who looked like he was on his way to a Hall of Fame career, then tapered off after a couple of years. So Ramczyk is pretty much as good as we've seen coming onto the scene in the PFF era. So love those two tackles. So those two guys being stars, they're stars at tackle, does that props up the line just a little bit. It makes up for what I would say the guard position being the biggest question marks for the Saints. When you have Andres Pete has not been great, but he did improve last year. He had a couple grades in the 40s. Last year he got it up to 60. That's your creeping back toward average for Andres Pete. And then Cesar Ruiz was their first round pick. Looked like a pretty good pass protector coming out of Michigan. He's still young. Pass pro was an issue for him last year on his way to a 53 grade. Eric McCoy, good solid center. He had a couple rough games last year that dragged him down. His grade was actually worse than he was as a center. But I think the 2 years of Eric McCoy at center for the Saints, you feel really good about him going forward. So you look at the Saints overall line, two pillars at tackle, a good center, average left guard. I think Ruiz can be an average right guard. You add that up, it's the number four offensive line. So they do have some holes there, but I expect those guys to get just a little bit better this year. The number three offensive line, it's the New England Patriots, another team just really good across the board. So they lost Joe Tooney. Joe Tooney has been a fantastic left guard, but just trading for Trent Brown, they bring Trent Brown back from the Raiders. And what makes the Patriots so good here is what happened with Michael Onwenu, their sixth round rookie last year. Onwenu had an 84 grade. We have never seen anything like that from a sixth round rookie. So Onwenu is the key here because he can play anywhere. Last year he did it. He played left guard, and right tackle. So that flexibility and that rookie performance was so good. It just allows the Patriots a little bit of flexibility. So Onwenu's going to start at left guard. Let's get to the other guys. Isaiah Wynn at left tackle, career high 82.6 grade. He's solid right there. And then they bring in Trent Brown. Brown has been a good pass protector. He's 360-plus pounds. You think he should maul people in the run game, and he does sometimes, but he'll lose some blocks. So he's an okay run blocker overall when you balance out the pluses and minuses. But Brown's best season came in 2018 when he was with the Patriots. So he comes back. He's going to play right tackle. So you got a good group of tackles. Shaq Mason, one of the best run-blocking guards in the entire league. He's going to play right guard. Onwenu, who I mentioned, he goes to left guard, and they bring back David Andrews, who's been just a good, steady center, pretty much a top 15 center, even though he dropped out a little bit last year, dropped down, but a top 15, top 10 type of center for the majority of his career. So no real weaknesses across the board for the Patriots. They also have a couple reasonable backups. Ted Karras is back as a backup. Justin Heron did a really nice job in limited time as a rookie last year. So the Patriots have a little bit of depth, solid starting group across the board. Number two team is the Indianapolis Colts. And this was solidified. I'm expecting Eric Fisher to be on the field. This is what completely solidified them as number two. So the Colts' biggest question mark coming into the offseason was that left tackle spot. If they didn't fill it with an Eric Fisher and it was Sam Tevy, we're still probably talking about the Colts as a top six or seven offensive line. At right tackle, Braden Smith came into the league with Quentin Nelson. Quentin Nelson we'll talk about in a second. Braden Smith came in with Quentin Nelson a couple years ago. He's been a top 15, top 20 type of tackle. Played even better at other times. 80 grade last year. He made one of the most rare moves. You just don't see this. From guard to tackle. We just talked about Onwenu doing it with the Patriots. He was a guard who had to fill in a tackle. You just don't see this often. Or at least you don't see it stick. Braden Smith was a college guard who became one of the best tackles in the NFL. So kudos to the Colts for finding a starting tackle out of a college guard. That doesn't happen often. That's outstanding. Fisher comes in to play left tackle. He is on that Donovan Smith same trajectory. I do like watching this. There are certain players that come into the league and it's like, man, they really struggled as rookies, but they get incrementally better. That was what Donovan Smith did. That's what Eric Fisher did. He was a, I don't want to use the word bust. I hate using the word bust, but he was not worth the number one overall pick in 2013 for the first 3 or 4 years of his career. But I think it was by about year four, better and better and better, and he's turned into a top 20 tackle, which I keep referencing because it's extremely valuable having a top 15 or top 20 starter. That's what Eric Fisher is when he's healthy. So you got Fisher, you got Braden Smith at tackle. Quentin Nelson's probably the best offensive lineman in the entire NFL. That guy has been as advertised since his rookie season. Mauls people in the run game. He's quick enough to make those zone blocks. Really good in pass pro. Quentin Nelson can do it all. So you've got the best guard in all of football. Mark Glowinski, former Seahawks player, right? He's another guy who's gotten a little bit better. He's kind of like what George Fant was with the Seahawks years ago. It's like, man, this dude's getting whooped all the time. What do the Seahawks see in this guy? The Seahawks have done this a few times where they've kind of taken their lumps with the young guy and then seen him shine elsewhere. And that's what Glowinski's done. He's turned into just a good, solid right guard. And that's what Ryan Kelly is at center as well. Ryan Kelly took a bit of a step back last year, but he was a top 10 center in 2019. He's been really consistent overall in his career. So we're talking about the Colts having a good tackle tandem, a great left guard, solid center, solid right guard. That's the number two offensive line in the NFL. That is how you describe a good offensive line. Not question marks, but solid plus across the board. And then you get to the Cleveland Browns. Last year, going into the season, we ranked them at number six in our offensive line rankings. We anticipated them being pretty good. They had ranked in the 20s in 2019. The 2019 season was marred by Baker, you know, kind of seeing ghosts, right? He's like, I don't trust my left tackle. I don't trust my right tackle. And he's bailing clean pockets. The line was maybe worse than it even felt at times. And they got, and we anticipated them getting better. They made some offseason moves to get them to our preseason number six ranking, but their actual ranking was first. Their actual performance last year was number one. And it was because of the breakout season from Wyatt Teller at right guard, but just all their moves that they made essentially paid off. Jack Conklin, they paid him a ton of money to play right tackle to shore that up. He had a career high 84 grade. Conklin, another guy. He's a good enough pass protector. He's an outstanding run blocker. So the run game on the right side was so good with Jack Conklin there and then Wyatt Teller, who I mentioned, the classic year three, year four breakout offensive lineman. He was really good in college, slow start with the Buffalo Bills. The Cleveland Browns take a shot on him, and he paid off last year. He had a 92.3 overall grade. There was a big disparity between pass and run blocking, but from a run blocking perspective, he was off the charts. Just an average pass blocker, room to improve there. But from a run game perspective, the right side of the Browns line was as good as it gets. J.C. Treader has been one of the most dependable starting centers his entire career. He's an 80-plus PFF player. Same thing with Joel Bitonio, 85 player. He has been one of the better guards in the entire NFL his entire career. Now, Jedrick Wills at left tackle, only a 62 grade. He disappointed a touch as a rookie. He was down a little bit in that Andrew Thomas range. I think that dropped a little bit later. But Wills showed what you need there. And I think when you're talking about from an offensive line perspective, Bitonio is a top five guard. Teller was a top, was the highest graded guard in the NFL. Conklin was a top 5 to 10 tackle, and Treader was a top five center. When you're really good at those four spots, you can handle average to below average play at the other spot. I think Jedrick Wills gets even better this year at left tackle. I also like the move they made in drafting James Hudson as a potential replacement down the road for Wyatt Teller if they can't pay him coming out of the season. Chris Hubbard's also a good backup. So the Browns have the starters. They have the depth. They have the actual on-field performance last year, and they're all coming back. this year, so they have to be the number one offensive line in the NFL. Are there any other interesting teams that we want to hear about? Let's go through some of the rest of the list. Again, you can check it all out at pff.com. I'm not just going to list all the teams, but a couple other notable rankings. The Dallas Cowboys at 6. The Cowboys last year finished 27th in our rankings, but it was because of injuries. Tyron Smith injured. Lyle Collins injured before the season. Hip surgery. We're going to assume some health for those guys. If they are healthy, they're really good. Lyle Collins had a career year in 2019. Tyron Smith has dropped off. He has absolutely dropped off. If you go back, watch him, watch his past sets back in 2015 or 16, it is textbook. It is just teaching tape for how you want to play the left tackle position. It is no longer the case. Tyron Smith has regressed to merely good. He also hasn't played a full season since 2015. So there are some question marks there, but he's a good left tackle. He remains a good left tackle. Lyle Collins could be a really good right tackle. So that's a good starting point for the Cowboys. Connor Williams, another year three breakout player last year. We could see another step forward from him. He finally graded in the green, got over 70 PFF grade. And that's a nice place to be. And then don't forget Zach Martin. I think he graded higher than Quentin Nelson last year at guard. He was the number two graded guard in the NFL last year. Martin's right there with Quentin Nelson, maybe the best all-around offensive lineman in the NFL. So on paper, the Cowboys are fine. The big questions at center, Tyler Biadasz, as a rookie last year, graded at 53. They just didn't get great performance at center overall, pretty much since Travis Frederick has retired a couple years ago, or at least got sick and then regressed. But the Cowboys have the pieces to bounce back and be pretty good. I said I wasn't going to go through the whole list, but I got the Chiefs at 7. Is that harsh? You guys want me to shut it down back there? I hear you. You want me to shut it down? I'm rolling right now. We'll wrap it up with this. The Kansas City Chiefs are at number 7. We're going to talk about the Chiefs a little bit with Eric later on. But for all the investment that they made, they're not perfect across the board. Orlando Brown at left tackle, that's good. He's been one of the better tackles in the league. Joe Tooney, one of the best guards. Remmers is a solid right tackle. Austin Blythe, good solid center. I use solid a lot because that's what they are. Light green players. That's what they have been these last couple years. And then right guard LDT comes back. The doctor and Kyle Long, they're the biggest question mark there. No stars on the board. Tooney's close. Orlando Brown's not really. They're not stars. That is good and solid across the board. That is what looks like the Steelers' offensive lines of the last few years until they dropped off. Just good starters across the board. That's what the Chiefs are. Number 7. Go check out the entire rankings over at pff.com. Before I bring in Eric Eager, don't forget PFF is partnered with Symbol. That's S-I-M-B-U-L-L, the stock market for sports that allows you to trade sports teams like stocks and earn cash payouts when your teams win. Symbol has blended sports and the stock market to offer you a new way to invest and profit off your favorite teams. MLB is in full swing, so you can use the rest of the summer to earn daily cash payouts, and there's still moves being made. NFL free agency, we've been saying, hey, NFL free agency is still happening. You can do this. Well, Julio Jones just got traded, so you can go invest in the Titans if you feel like that's the way to go, or maybe, sell the Falcons because they just lost Julio Jones. That's how you do it. Use promo code PFF and deposit $10 at symbol.app/PFF to earn a free PFF annual subscription. That's promo code PFF with a $10 deposit at symbol.app/PFF to earn a free annual subscription. All right, let's get to Eric Eager. Great discussion on analytics and everything that they're doing over there at the PFF Forecast. All right, welcome in to Eric Eager. He's the guy. He's the numbers guy over on the PFF Forecast. You guys, if you haven't already subscribed to their podcast, go check it out because they're doing great work. Everything you need, betting, gambling, or just all NFL and looking forward. Eric, how are we doing this morning?
Things are going okay. Last week was like the first time in God knows how long that I didn't have like a radio hit or something, like a TV hit or something. And I was like, oh, this is refreshing. I get to do like my actual job now. And then of course Julio gets traded and like my phone is like, just with blowing up with requests. So It's good. It's good to realize and know that football is king. And even on June 6th and now 7th, you know, it is the top story.
It is great because every June, I feel like we get those reminders. That June or the first week of June is when the infamous Sam Munson, we notice Sam's not here, Sam article about Tom Brady. You've got Tresh in late May trending because he forgot that Randy Moss played football. I'm just kidding, Tresh. Yeah. We know Tyreek Hill. He's great. But yeah, what people don't know, Eric, is yeah, you're vice president of what? Director of what now? What's your real role? Because the on-air stuff is just a piece of what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm the VP of Research and Development. My group builds, you know, sort of the intelligence that goes into a lot of the, well, all of the sort of tools that people use for fantasy gambling. Also, what I think you've talked about on your show a number of times, IQ, the product that we sell to teams. Just, you know, all that kind of stuff, you know, sort of originates in our group. And it's great. It's fun to be able to, you know, talk football not only with you, but also with, you know, mathematicians like Timo Riske and folks like that, where it's, you know, it's just a lot of fun. And we get to explore sort of notions about the game that before I worked at PFF were only my theories.
All right, so we'll get into some of the nuts and bolts there because I think it's great. You guys are really the foundation for everything that you know that our fans are seeing, and also the NFL teams, as you said, and college teams. Let's talk Julio, though. You guys covered it on the PFF forecast. Go check out their breakdown as well. But what was your instant reaction to Julio going to the Titans and pairing up with A.J. Brown?
Well, interestingly, I think that this salvages a little bit of the offseason for the Titans.
That's my feeling too. That's exactly my feeling.
When I look at sort of like what they haven't done, it kind of reminds me of some of the teams that were more fragile going into last season that ended up struggling because of the pandemic, but also because of the, you know, foreseeable injuries and things like that. Where you look, and I know Adoree Jackson didn't play much last year. And I know Malcolm Butler actually had a good season. Desmond King wasn't all that great, but you still have to replace those guys in the secondary. And I don't know if Janoris Jenkins and a draft pick are going to do it quite as quickly as people think. They also got a pass rusher who's not very good at pass rushing, but has a lot of sacks and Bud Dupree. And so I don't think their defense got appreciably better. While I think two of the teams in their division might have gotten better, Indianapolis probably takes a step back with Rivers gone and Wentz in his place, but I think Jacksonville certainly gets better. And on the offensive side of the ball, you lose Davis, you lose Jonnu Smith, you lose Ryan, you lose Dennis Kelly on the right side of the offensive line. And then I think most importantly to all this conversation, you lose Arthur Smith. And so when my reaction to this trade was, okay, Tennessee might salvage this season. On the Falcons side, it's unfortunate that it came to this, but ultimately, once you start adding it up, it's like, well, they can't even pay their draft picks if this were to happen. They really did tie themselves up. I mean, I understand taking Kyle Pitts in the sense that you did what you did with Matt Ryan's contract. It would have made a rookie quarterback difficult to square with both of those contracts on the same team for 2 years. And so this was sort of the natural course of things for Atlanta, which is unfortunate because I think if Julio would have stayed with them, given Arthur Smith, Pitts, and then Calvin Ridley, who emerged a season ago as the number one receiver, I think that offense could have been really scary. I think now it'll just be moderately frightening.
So it is amazing because one of the you developed WAR, our wins above replacement metric, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But one of the things I always describe to our listeners is just in football, the impact of a star player is so negligible compared to the impact of a star player in other sports, other than quarterback. Right, the quarterback is in a different world. But generally, when you see a great defensive lineman or even a corner, and they have an impact, but it's not at the same as like a, I always use like a James Harden, if he went from one team to another, or Mike Trout goes from one team to another. Those are, and it's any position, an outfielder or a shortstop. If they go from one team to another, they make the same impact, right? Or a point guard versus a center, it's pretty close. But Julio, is he different? You know, how much of an impact does he really make? And since we always talk about the value of the quarterback and having that top guy, what do you make of Matt Ryan and his career and how Julio, just the difference in performance with Julio versus without Julio? So in other words, is Julio the most valuable non-quarterback in the NFL.
He's been the second most valuable non-quarterback in the NFL since he entered the league. Antonio Brown, I think, has a slight edge over him, which is actually pretty impressive given how much Brown has missed over the past two or three seasons. But, yeah, he's great. I mean, you're talking about a guy in his prime who adds a win to a team. You know, nowadays, you know, he was about a quarter of a win, a third of a win player last season in limited time. Previous season, he was about 8/10 of a win. So, like, if you assume some health and playing a decent amount, he's probably going to be, you're like, you can imagine a half a win. And that's kind of what you saw in the betting markets. Tennessee over 9 wins. Like, it didn't really move that much, but I think that there was some implication that he'd be there. And it kind of traveled up a little bit. I do think people are betting into the Titans a little bit now. But yeah, he's an extremely valuable player. It's changed the way I've thought about football in the sense that, like, if you can't get open, like, the everything else sort of creaks, right? Like, the offensive line looks bad. You know, but Julio's done just a yeoman's work of getting open over the past few seasons. And Ryan, without him, has not been quite as good. And I think one of the dings that you can have for, you know, one of the positives you can look at with this trade is this idea of, you know, Julio hasn't played 900 or more snaps, I think, since their Super Bowl season, if I'm not mistaken, maybe 2017. I have to go back and look. And so, like, his yards per route run are always so high, but he does take a ton of plays off, even when healthy-ish. And maybe the Falcons are thinking, you know, most of this is out of necessity, but maybe partially because thinking of, okay, well, if he's not all that reliable on the field in terms of being on the field all the time, maybe we just need to move on. And much like Matthew Stafford had to learn to play without Megatron, Matt Ryan, if he's going to be the franchise quarterback that they're paying him to be, he's got to learn how to play without Julio Jones. I'm trying to sort of put lipstick on a pig here in that decision, but that does appear like if you're trying to look at a, you know, some reasoning as to why the Falcons would do something like this other than the cap, that might be one. In that Julio simply has not been on the field as much as some of the other receivers who are playing 1,000 snaps or more.
And that's likely a part of the war equation that you talked about with Antonio Brown. You know, being on the field is part of the value equation, so to speak. So if you are being extremely productive on fewer snaps, that will hurt overall. I'm with you, though, as far as the Titans needed to salvage this offseason because they came in with massive holes in the secondary, right tackle was an issue, and then receiver. I just ranked all the receiver and tight end units. We have to go back and re-rank it. I actually pre-wrote, you know, if Julio goes to the Titans. But they were 27th, I believe, in the rankings last week because it was A.J. Brown and then Josh Reynolds as the number two. And then maybe a rookies, Racy McMath and Dez Fitzpatrick and, you know, a whole bunch of guys who have not done anything in the NFL. I think the Titans needed Julio more than any other team. And now that vaults them probably right around 10. They don't have depth when it comes to pass catchers with Jonnu Smith moving on, but it was just much needed. And I don't want to explore Ryan Tannehill without pretty good pass catchers. I don't want to see him. Most of his career, he hasn't had that. And, you know, the last 2 years, he's been fantastic, but I just don't want to see him with subpar pass catchers. So I felt it was like a necessary move with the Titans. I got to talk Derrick Henry really quick because you guys are team running backs don't matter. Just so we know, this is the, Eric, this is the nuanced podcast here, the PFF NFL podcast. I like to bring nuance, and I don't like to say running backs don't matter. I say maybe they're just not as valuable as you think. But you guys on the forecast, you're bold, and you just say it like it is. But I gotta bring up Derrick Henry. Is he the outlier? How do we explain Derrick Henry, and legitimately how much value does he actually bring to the table, even if it's perceived as just incredible across the NFL?
Yeah, I mean, I actually wrote this in the Pittsburgh Steelers article last week as to the whole, like, why PFF isn't the only one that hates Pittsburgh. And I think running backs don't matter is sort of this quip that is meant to cover up the idea that running back, like, the running game is not all that sensitive to the strength of the running back. And running backs, generally speaking, don't end up, you know, being worth the deals that they sign for or the draft picks that they end up with. You can get 2 year stretches. Like I'll say, like, Henry was worth about a quarter of a win the last 2 years. Alvin Kamara, similarly, that's high for a running back. And we've seen, whether it be the big data bowl data or some of the stuff that we've done internally, like, he's been able to maintain brilliance for longer than most running backs. Now the question becomes, when you sort of take a step back and look and say, okay, predictively, what does that mean for Tennessee after you give him, like, you know, 400 or so touches? What is that? What is, like, this season, what does it mean for him to be, you know, when I think we hold it constant that he's going to be amazing this year, and we hold it, and it's like, well, that's like not great. Like, the things that you try to hold constant in the NFL are things that sort of are stable, right? Like, when I talk about Kansas City, it's like head coach, quarterback. Those are the most stable things in the world. I'm going to bank on that. Once you start getting into the, okay, the play of the running back, the play of the secondary, the play, it's like those are a little bit tenuous. And so you can sort of whack-a-mole and fix other things. But, like, what sneaks up on you, and I talk about Minnesota this way because I think that they're very similar last season to what the Titans are this year. When you whack-a-mole on one side of the roster, then the other things sort of, like, sneak up on you and don't perform as well. And I think that that's maybe a leak for the Titans. Now, they are going to play – they're going to face a lot more too high, right, and a lot fewer men in the box. So maybe Henry can overcome some, you know, what would be perceived downswings in performance by just facing lighter boxes. But that's something when you choose to be negative on Tennessee, I think that's a reasonable issue to have with them, which is just that they've given Henry so many carries. And while I think it's amazing that he's been able to sort of overcome expectations over the past few years, like, expectations, like, most players are the rule and not the exception. And if you let time go on long enough, most people end up being the rule.
Tennessee is so fascinating. I always say they've got the dudes on the field. There are certain games where Derrick Henry just decides, I'm going to be bigger, faster, stronger than everybody. A.J. Brown does that. Julio Jones now has that. And I think, you know, Caleb Farley at corner, their first rounder, you know, has that ability. But from a cornerback standpoint, Tennessee is one of those teams where it might just be their stars potentially taking over. I don't want to spend all day on Tennessee, but with Ryan Tannehill, I think it's easy to downplay Derrick Henry by saying, well, Derrick Henry was there before Ryan Tannehill. Why wasn't Derrick Henry this great? He was good, but he wasn't this great when Marcus Mariota was the quarterback. But it's not like they brought in Tom Brady or Aaron Rodgers and then Derrick Henry got better. They brought in Ryan Tannehill, so it's like this chicken or egg type thing. Ryan Tannehill was a Marcus Mariota-ish level quarterback before he became 90-plus grade Ryan Tannehill over the last 2 years. What do you make of Tannehill's career in this resurgence over the last couple years?
I think it's weird. I said that, and people get offended no matter what you say about quarterbacks, so, like, I don't care. But, like, the Tannehill – Todd Downing's the offensive coordinator now. In 2017, when he got his turn, his one chance to be OC, in our offensive coordinator rankings in that season, he was the worst. 31st was Dowell Loggins, 30th with that was Adam Gase. Adam Gase, of course, not that particular season, that was Jay Cutler because Tannehill was hurt. But Adam Gase, obviously the coordinator that got the worst out of Ryan Tannehill in 2018 as a member of the Miami Dolphins. So, like, I think Tannehill has shown me enough over the past two seasons to sort of imply that he's better than a quarterback that's going to be the absolute worst when his play calling is the absolute worst, and the absolute best when his play calling is the absolute best. But I do think any reasonable person is going to look at this and say, okay, part of it was Arthur Smith, but Arthur Smith coached the first six or seven games of the 2019 season. And I always joke, like, everybody says that Henry was, you know, Henry set up Tannehill. I was like, well, that's awfully inconsiderate of Henry not to have set up Marcus Mariota the first right. 6 weeks of that year. And, you know, but at the same time, like, you know, I do think that it was a good marriage between Tannehill and Smith. And you take Smith out of that equation and you put in Downing, who I know is promoted internally. But we've seen this happen before. We saw Sarkisian promoted internally for Shanahan.
Right.
It's just not the same intuition, right? Like, if a guy developed the offense himself, you just get better play calling than the guy that comes in and says, not to worry, I'm going to call the exact same plays. And that almost never works out. And so that's another ding. Like, to me, Julio is going to have to overcome a defense that's not quite as good, an offense, the rest of the weapons, which aren't quite as good. I know they acquired Josh Reynolds, but he's just a guy. And the inevitable regression that comes with changing offensive coordinators, because, like, the league's trying to catch up to the Titans too. And to me, I see it as two moving things. The league is catching up to what Arthur Smith is doing. You saw that a bit last year. They weren't quite as efficient. in many ways, especially in the passing game, as they were in 2019 and Tannehill starts. But then you also have the fact that the actual guy who is responsible for all that efficiency as the play caller is being taken out for sort of a discount version of that. And so those are two things that are competing against the Titans this season. And Julio's got to overcome those, and Tannehill's got to overcome those. And while I think Tannehill's good enough to not completely flounder in this situation, I think it's a reasonable assumption that he won't be as good as he was, you know, the last, you know, season and a half.
But I thought that last year too, and he started off that way, but he started, you know, but by middle of the season, Tannehill was really good again. But it is true because it's such a run heavy attack, it's basically like a season and a quarter of elite play from Tannehill, right? It's because he started late in 2019. It's really about a season and a quarter. So I agree that there's probably some regression there. What you said about changing coordinators, though, I didn't want to discuss this, but it reminds me of the Rams. I discussed them on the last podcast a little bit, how I feel like the betting markets are so high on the Rams. I feel like everything is so – we might be so high on the Rams. Like, what is pushing people toward the Rams? And defensively, not only were they one of the best last year, they did not allow anything down the field. How much does losing Brandon Staley, he was the coordinator last year, how much does losing Brandon Staley, going from him to Raheem Morris? There's a little bit of a Sarkisian Shanahan situation there, right? Is Raheem Morris going to run the same defense? Is he going to run what he knows a little bit more? Is there a hybrid? Were the Rams just going to regress anyway? Are we too high on the Rams and Matthew Stafford being the guy over there?
Those are a lot of great questions. I think my answer to why people are so excited about the Rams is, like, who else is there to be excited about in the NFC, right? You look at this sort of betting markets, and it's very clearly Tampa Bay, right. Your guy Brady. I think, like, my podcast co-host George Shahuri was trying to talk me into Tom Brady for MVP, and I'm like, dude, like, they might be uncontested the whole season. We might never even see them on Sunday Night Football flex because they're going to be like 10-point favorites in every game in the second half of the year. And, you know, then
I think
from
it's
there,
a,
who
I
is
think
it,
it's
right?
a good MVP
like,
bet. We
Green
went through
Bay,
this
Green
the other
Bay
day.
Green Bay without Rodgers is not, you know, Green Bay with Rodgers is clearly second, I think.
Right.
But we're not assured Rodgers is going to be there. And then after that, it's what? San Francisco? San Francisco might be starting a rookie quarterback by the time. And then you have LA, you have Seattle, but Seattle is like the plus 300 to win their own division. Then you go to the NFC North and, you know, sure, you can make a case for Minnesota, Chicago. You go to the East, Dallas, okay, I guess, like, they have an elite quarterback, but who knows? Washington, like, are we really counting on Ryan Fitzpatrick to take a team and add some wins to that? Maybe the Giants will sneak up on people this year. But the answer is really, like, who else is there to like in the NFC?
Yeah.
And then so it sort of takes you back to the intrigue of Stafford, which I don't really see it, but you know, obviously everybody else is. McVay, of course. I think you make an excellent point about Raheem Morris. The interesting thing here, last year Los Angeles was first in the NFL in terms of avoiding missed tackles. The Atlanta Falcons were in the bottom half of the league. Like, there are some, like, aspects of teams like L.A., Indianapolis, where you look in that, you're like, okay, how is this team doing this with either, like, you know, stars and scrubs? And in the case of Indianapolis, far more scrubs than stars. But even in L.A., where you have a few really good players, and then Darius Williams is in the world and so on, and they're solid. They don't give teams extra yards. They don't give teams extra completions, to your point about not giving up big plays. And I don't know if it completely transfers. We saw it when Fangio left the Bears and went to go coach the Denver Broncos. Like, the Bears defense was fine under Chuck Pagano, but not like elite, not number one in the NFL, not to, you know, good enough to win with. And you know, to me, if you take away LA, if you put him on defense number six in the NFL, that's a lot of ground for Matthew Stafford to cover in a tough division.
All right. I want to discuss some of the findings you've had throughout the years, and this is what I love, right? So just the quick history of PFF. Somebody started grading in 2008. That was Ben Stockwell. He started grading every player on every play. We eventually backfilled 2006 and 7. So there was a point where we had about 10 years of NFL data, and we had some, you know, we had some intuition about, you know, hey, these grades are valuable and they will help predict things, but we never really knew Eric, until you pretty much showed up, started playing with the data a little bit, and you, what I like is you either confirmed things that we thought and maybe said them in a more technical way, or you completely came up with something new that I didn't necessarily think. So one of the things you confirmed was our favorite line here is that, you know, offensive lines just need to creep back toward average, right? So like intuitively we knew the teams with the best offensive lines, they're not the best offenses, but the teams that have terrible offensive lines, they've got no shot. So if you're at least somewhere in between, then you point to the QBs and the receivers, right? So we'll talk about that in a sec. The one that I was like, man, are you sure? Like, rerun this algorithm. This isn't right. The pass rush versus coverage debate. The idea that coverage was more valuable than pass rush. And I understand, but it's just counterintuitive to what we think from a traditional football standpoint. And there's a lot of, they depend on each other, right? We know that there's some overlap. And then there's the idea of where I'm in between here. It's defense doesn't matter. And that goes back to like, we make this declarative statement, defense doesn't matter. And a lot of people get pissed off and a lot of people think about it in a more nuanced way, right? So I want to discuss those three, starting with the offensive line. We say creep back toward average. What have you found as far as the offensive line and just the importance of the overall unit in that starting five?
Well, it's hard because it's a position that takes things on, right? And I think about it very similar to the way I think about being a defensive back in many ways, in the sense that the defensive line sort of gets to choose how it attacks you. The things that you do positively, so this is the one difference between being a defensive back, I think, is the positive things you do, like the benefits are very limited by what other players do around you, but the negative things you do can almost eliminate the positive things that other people do for you. You know what I'm saying? So like, yep, we have a lot of like low war values for players on the offensive line, because like, if you jump off sides, that's 5 yards. And that's like an expected point, let's say, and that's all your fault. And
I mean, it's like giving up a sack. It's giving up a sack, essentially.
Yeah. And giving up a sack is a little different because the quarterback, I think, bears some responsibility.
I'm just saying for impact perspective, not as far as like how well you played, but it's like when you lose 5 yards, it's like losing five, but except you get the down back. But yeah,
exactly. Think about this: for an offensive lineman to recoup that positive value, right? He has to probably be perfect on the rest of his pass blocking snaps, and the team has to sort of come up big on the pass. You know, like, I always think about it this way: like, you can have a Tyron Smith blocking for Sam Bradford, but if Bradford checks it down every single play, like, what's the point? You know what I mean? And like you, for every negative play you make, almost all of the blame goes to you. But every positive play you make, you share credit with all the other players in the offense. So that's why it's so hard. So your job is not to be brilliant, because brilliance doesn't matter if there's nothing else, you know, on the rest of your team. Your job is to simply not give up that many things.
Right.
And that's why, again, when you look at, you know, some of the crazy war values for these linemen, it's really like the TJ Clemmings of the world that stand out to me more than it is like the Ryan Ramcheks of the world or the Mitchell Schwartzes of the world that stand out from a positive perspective, because you need to be amazing and then have your offense capitalize on it to be all that valuable. So that's kind of an interesting truism. I always felt that like it was important, and like there are salary cap implications that I just feel like with adding Brad Spielberger and I think just becoming more intelligent as a company about it, there are salary cap implications about these positions that I don't think we quite incorporated into our analysis until recently. But I think our understanding of offensive line play is very much different than you just need to get an amazing left tackle and everything will work itself out. Which I think is a little counter to what many people believe.
Yeah, and it's what you said before, right? Like, when we talk about a secondary, when Kevin King's out on the field, Tom Brady can attack Kevin King every single time if he wants. And you have to put a safety over the top maybe to help him. The offensive line is the same way. You can have that amazing left tackle, but if you have a bad right guard, it's not that difficult to attack the guard or the other tackle or whatever. So the idea of being good across the board. What about we speak in these big high level axioms, pass rush versus coverage. It's always far more nuanced than that. And I've explained this one a lot on this show. I think when you really think about it, you know, just the fact that 65% of pass plays have no pressure in the NFL, if not more. It does make sense. Okay, the pass rush can be negated. And we've seen this intuitively. Quick passing attacks. Brady's Patriots have done this for years, you know, just negated a pass rush. But when you came, was this a conclusion you were surprised with? Or did you, what were your expectations when you started to debate the merits of, say, the back seven versus the front four?
Yeah, I mean, there's a great quote. I think it says, revere those who are searching for the truth and doubt those who find it. Like, I very much am trying to disprove this every single day because it's not what I think. And, you know, you've watched football you watch football and our view of the game is very much based upon watching the broadcast copy, which only sees pass rush in many cases. Like we only see the outcome of coverage, but we can watch the process of pass rush. So we always sort of like, you know, it's the availability heuristic. We're looking at what we see and we're like, oh, this is important. And I think that has creeped in, but you know, I would consider them at least equal. And here's why. I think, you know, you can negate a pass rush by throwing quickly. You can also curb good coverage obviously gives rise. Like we've seen them sort of correlate with each other. Like I think the second pass rush versus coverage article, we showed that great coverage grades give rise to longer times to throw. Well, longer times to throw yield higher pressure rates.
Sure.
Right. So you have that, but also great pressure rates yield just faster times to throw. So if you're going against Tampa Bay in the Super Bowl, you're going to throw the ball more quickly. So then it's easier to cover, obviously, the less time you have to cover. So there's obviously a correlation between the two, and they sort of go hand in hand. But even in a game, this is where, like, I think my orientation is different than many. Even in a game like the Super Bowl, where it's clear Patrick Mahomes is under siege the whole time, they're on 80% of their offensive line is banged up with injuries. So everybody's looking at that, and the Chiefs obviously too, since, you know, they made all these moves. I went and wrote an article. I said, like, well, I actually think it was because Sammy Watkins was injured, Byron Pringle's a, you know, replacement level receiver, and Mecole Hardman hasn't come around. And I looked at the data, and it's like, yeah, the offense goes as the third or fourth or fifth passing option go. Because if you're Tampa set the table for their pressure to be great because they allocated coverage resources to Kelce and Hill, who were always the Chiefs. Like, the Chiefs were dealing with 60% of their offensive line was hurt the whole year. It was Eric Fisher that broke the camel's back, apparently. But what it really was Tampa saying, look, we're not scared of Watkins. We're not scared of Hardman. We're not scared of Pringle. We're going to put two guys each on Kelce and Hill. And then when Mahomes hits his back foot and neither of those guys is open, then he's got to throw the ball to a guy he doesn't really trust. He's got to move around. And by the time that little hesitancy that's caused by coverage, that's more than enough for elite pass rushers like, you know, Sue, Vea, Barrett, and Pierre Paul to come in and make plays. And to me, again, that's like this sort of symbiotic relationship there. But the fact that the Chiefs had to limit their route tree because their line was bad and their pressure against them was so good, that's a pass rush influence in coverage situation. So it sort of goes both ways, and it's a really interesting topic.
So what do you make of how the Chiefs responded to that? It's one thing if Eric Fisher was healthy coming into this offseason. If Eric Fisher was healthy and Mitchell Schwartz was healthy and they could maintain those two guys, I mean, those guys, they're one of the better tackle tandems in the NFL. Eric Fisher's developed and he's been good. Mitchell Schwartz has been arguably the best right tackle in the NFL. So they had to replace both guys. And they've got this bitter taste in their mouth about the Super Bowl. Yeah. And I keep thinking that I think they overreacted a little bit to the offensive line. I know they had to replace those two tackles. I think they overreacted a little bit with their investment. Where do you stand on all of the moves the Chiefs have made on the O-line?
Well, they're not going to get a good return on Orlando Brown. I mean, I think that's a pretty clear thing.
Why is that?
I asked them sort of like what was that, they're like, well, we just don't have a left tackle. Like, we just literally don't have somebody who's an NFL caliber player there. And actually, they're probably right. Like, Remmers is a right tackle at best.
Sure.
Lucas Niang's a right tackle at TCU, I think. And so they needed a left tackle. But, like, and we've done this analysis over and over, like, the value of that draft pick they sold to Baltimore. Like, Orlando Brown's been one of the most valuable tackles in the league, but he did so in a very easy system. And he would need, I said, something like five or six times more valuable than that draft position to end up making that pick work. We'll see what ends up happening. But they're just not going to get good value. That being said, like, we do this thing all the time, right? You and I buy insurance, you know, and insurance is a negative EV play for the buyer. That's why insurance companies exist, right? So like we all do these things that like that help protect us, that if you ran the course of our life 10,000 times would not be worth it, right? And so the Chiefs, I think, are doing that. And what they have as an ace in the hole is the fact that their quarterback, I think, very much took a page out of Tom Brady and made a contract that was very, very team friendly. I think Mahomes, the most impressive thing about him, aside from, you know, how fast he's gone on the scene, is I think his like mentality's right. Like he wants to win Super Bowls, and I think having the highest contract or having the highest per year, like I think that means less to him than the you know, $500 million would suggest. And so that gave the Chiefs some flexibility. They don't have but I do agree with you. I think they overdid it. I think the Tooney thing is probably where they overdid it. But, you know, if you look at sort of their investment on the O-line, I mean, they let Mitch Morse go. They let Rodney Hudson go. They let Zach Fulton go. They let Jeff Allen go. They've never invested on the interior of the offensive line. And maybe that's where they see, oh, there's our leak. I don't agree with it. I think if you have two good tackles, you can patch up the interior. But I think I think the Tooney signing was really the signal that they were going in a different direction philosophically from what they had always gone.
So that's the investment. A huge contract for Tooney, the first rounder for Orlando Brown, but they also have to pay him a year from now as well. So they're at some point, they're going to have like $35 million locked up just in the left side. And I always preface this with Patrick Mahomes is awesome. He's the best quarterback in the league, but we've never seen him without Tyreek Hill and Travis Kelce, right? And Eric, I always compare it to the Patriots dynasty, right? The only times the Patriots weren't a slam dunk Super Bowl caliber team is when their playmakers just were. There were a few years where their playmakers were like bottom three, bottom five in the league. So, and then they rectified it, right? They don't, okay, now we're getting Randy Moss, or now we're going to make sure that we've got guys for Tom Brady to throw to. I don't know if the Chiefs want to explore that. You know, I feel like you could explore the world where they have the 20th ranked offensive line and survive. I don't know if you want to explore the world where Tyreek Hill gets hurt or loses a step or Kelce, and you have a bottom five or bottom 10 group of playmakers there.
Yeah, they were 9-1 last year in games decided by one score, including, I think, the last seven wins they had of the season were by a score or less, maybe it was six. I think they felt like they were playing too close to the fire last year at times, you know, with an offensive line. I think their starters were like, you know, was it Fisher? Osemele got injured. Duvernay-Tardif was a doctor all season, and then Mitchell Schwartz was hurt. And then they were sort of piecing center together, you know, week by week. So, and they would win these games, but they'd only win them, you know, they'd win them close, right? They wouldn't cover the spread, for example. And I think maybe they felt, okay, we're moving too close. But yeah, I mean, if you look at like, and I don't know if this is a canary in the coal mine or just a sign of changing the way he plays, but Travis Kelce's on-field speed, if you look at NGS or, you know, however you want to measure it, has gone down monotonically the last 4 years. Even though he's still brilliant, you wonder, you know, is there a threshold after which he's no longer elite?
So you've quantified
so much differently than Gronk does.
You've quantified, you know, game speed did, and seen the decline in Kelce over the last 4 years. As from speeds, you've quantified game speed and seen the decline in Kelce over the last 4 years. Not necessarily in production, but just pure game speed.
Yeah, his production is if anything, better, right?
Right.
But maybe it's changed. Like when Alex was his quarterback, he was catching bubble screens and running them 70 yards to the house. And now he's sort of more of like, and look, in the playoff game against the Browns, he like was one-on-one with Denzel Ward and shook the heck out of him and
right.
Scored a touchdown. Like, I'm not saying he's declining. I'm saying like he's getting older, right? And Tyreek Hill is somewhat injury prone too. And like the question is, you know, when Mahomes is on his rookie deal, you can have the luxury that Sammy Watkins was at $16 million a year to be your third option, but you don't have it anymore. You have to hit on Mecole Hardman. You have to squeeze value out of DeMarcus Robinson, and they, you know, they try to sign Josh Reynolds. Josh Reynolds, I think, probably regrets going to Tennessee for $100,000 more than what the Chiefs offered him. Juju Smith-Schuster, they tried to sign him. They got Cornell Powell in the draft. He's one of those guys has to work out, exactly to your point, because it's not clear that Hill and Kelce are going to play forever.
All right, let's wrap it up with this. The famous statement that defense doesn't matter, right? I mean, it's an easy statement to be like, what are you talking about? Defense wins championships, and I've seen this, and I've seen... Explain exactly what that means, and does it really not matter? Because obviously, we just saw the Bucks have a good defensive performance and win the Super Bowl. What is the message you're trying to convey with that statement?
Well, I'll just say this. So, from a DFS and gambling perspective, like, and a props betting perspective, you know me, I bet a lot of these.
Yes.
And there was a stretch in the 2019 season where Alvin Kamara's rushing prop was the exact same number every single game for like 6 weeks straight. So, like, clearly the markets are not pricing in defense. Those markets are not necessarily the sharpest in the world, but like, the markets aren't pricing in defense all that much. Defense does matter from a matchups perspective. Like, I think like the cover three teams, for example, against Kansas City do a lot better than the Ravens type teams or the Steelers types teams that play more man coverage and blitz and stuff like that. So like, obviously matchups matter. The whole premise of this is if I'm trying to predict what happens in the NFL and the first thing you say to me is, yeah, but their defense is this, and especially in the extreme, I'm going to almost always push back, because it's so difficult for a defense to repeat as the number one group. It's so difficult for defense to repeat as the number 32 group, right? And we've seen examples of this, you know, throughout, like the Jacksonville and Minnesota in 2017. 2018, they're not even in the playoffs. Bears in 2018, 2019, they're not in the playoffs. And these defenses didn't become like 1 to 32. They went from 1 to 8, right? But then the offense has to sort of cover that spread, and offense is far more stable year to year. And so to ask your offense to make a titanic leap or to expect it to take a gigantic fall is a lot harder than to expect that to defense. You look at Kansas City, 2018, they were worst defense in the NFL. 2019, they're merely average, and that's enough to win the Super Bowl and to be more comfortable in the second half of the season than they were in 2018, where they were grinding out, you know, having to win shootouts every single week. So defense doesn't matter is not true, right? It's an inflammatory statement, but it is a good way to think about, okay, if I'm thinking too much, if I'm trying to predict a game and I'm thinking too much about the defense before I'm thinking about how the table's set by quarterback, offensive coordinator, organizational strength, let's even say, because I think a team like the Colts is not particularly talented on defense, but they're an A-plus organization, in my opinion. If I'm not thinking of those things first and then using defense as sort of a second order variable, then I think I'm doing it wrong.
So that, look at that. There is a nuanced way to it. So I see this all the time in our little, Twitter football bubble, right? We see this all the time. And I feel like there's other analytics folks who are like, oh, you know, people think that analytics says this, or people think that analytics says that. Is there an issue in the messaging there? Because if the messaging is, like, if half the people are like, you think running backs don't matter, I'm not listening to you ever again, or you said defense doesn't matter, you're an idiot, the 2015 Broncos won with defense, and right? So how do you communicate this stuff? Because you just did it great in a nuanced way, right? I mean, it's like defense matters less than offense. I mean, that's the truth of it. So how do you balance what your findings are versus some of those inflammatory statements, as you said?
Yeah, the defense, by the way, the Denver Broncos have not only not made the playoffs since they won the Super Bowl with their defense, but have not even beat Kansas City since they won the Super Bowl,
right?
Because of defense. And I think that shows sort of exactly what you're talking about, which is defense can matter in the moment, but it's a fleeting thing, right? It's something, because again, like we just had a discussion about offense. What do you need for offense to be great? You need a good coach, a good offensive coordinator, some combination of a good enough offensive line, good enough weapons, good quarterback, and good offensive coach. Like, that's four things. That's actually not that many, and you don't even need all four of them at once. Defense, you need five secondary players that are above average or better, because the offense will exploit your weakness.
Because you can get attacked.
You need at least one good pass rusher, but probably two. And you need linebackers that aren't a complete disaster in the run game and the pass game. Like, that's more – those are more degrees of freedom or more degrees – and then you also have the fact that on offense, you're attacking. So if you don't have a great set of weapons, you can sort of hide that better. Then if you have a bad secondary, the other team is not going to hide that for you. They're going to actually do the exact opposite. So I think from a messaging standpoint, it's interesting because I have this in my Twitter bio. Football's fun, right? So like football, you like talking trash. You like, you know, it's sort of a trash talking aspect to it. And the other thing is, and you, I think you taught me this, Steve, like, don't explain yourself. Like, no, I just talked about running backs don't matter. I think, you know, I actually said, you know, I think running backs do matter in some cases. And I think Derrick Henry's one of them. But, and then once you say but, every Titans fan has stopped listening to you anyway, right? So what's the point of, like, going from the whole, like, I actually am going to downplay the whole idea of Henry to, like, I think the gaps are asymmetrical. You know what I mean? And I think, like, having shorthand that we talk about with our friends on Twitter, I sort of think about Twitter as sort of like an open mic night for comics, you know, for football analysts. Like, I'm riffing out there, and you know, some of my friends in the analytics community are like, oh, I'm picking up what you're putting down. But then we have these discussions intelligently with football people, and they know, like, everybody who's talked to any one of us, George, me, Timo, anybody, knows that we don't actually think defense doesn't matter. We just think we say defense doesn't matter as sort of a shorthand to say, of the things I think about first, defense doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So I think that that's really where you get kind of the disconnect. But the fact of the matter is, most people aren't listening to your third and fourth words anyway, right? So whether, you know, if you get out the first order thing, then that's kind of, you know, I'd rather that first order thing be a strongly held opinion than a, or not like a strong opinion weakly held, than it being like something wishy-washy, because then no one's, you know, that's why football analytics before we showed up wasn't making any headway, right? Because people would, you know, for good or bad, like we've moved the message forward quite a bit by making inflammatory statements and then explaining ourselves to the people with good faith later.
Would you agree within a season, however, how do you handle this? If last season you've got Aaron Rodgers, DFS or otherwise, and he's going to play the Rams defense, and I know he beat them in the playoffs, he's going to play the Rams defense versus the Falcons defense. Falcons got torched all last year. The Rams were that team that, you know, wasn't allowing big plays and everything. How much does that affect your perception of Rodgers going into that week, whether it's from a fantasy DFS standpoint or simply I'm predicting the Packers to win or lose or cover the spread?
Great question. I mean, I would say the Packers and the Rams game in the playoffs illustrates exactly why we overcorrect for defense, right? Because literally one thing happens, and that's Aaron Donald gets injured for half the game. And what was the biggest lock of the entire season, which is the Rams defense is amazing, shut down Tampa Bay, shut down Seattle three times, you know, right, et cetera, et cetera, it becomes exactly nothing right away. Whereas, you know, it takes like literally the quarterback getting hurt, the most protected position on the planet, or, you know, in the case of Andy Reid, like a you know, monumental distraction to curb those things, right? So yeah, I mean, of course, like if I have the Packers in the playing in a dome against the Atlanta Falcons versus if I had another copy of the Packers playing outside in Lambeau Field against the Rams, like I'm going to take the Packers against the Falcons, but at the same time, like there's never like those two things, you know, like the characteristics of the Packers, I think, are more unique than the differences between the Rams and the Falcons once you play the whole game out, because so many things can happen that like affect that rating, whereas not that much can affect Rodgers' rating versus, let's say, the next quarterback, like Stafford, let's say.
All right, Eric, I know you got to go, but one last thing I need you to confirm for me. Domes do really matter, right? How big of an impact do domes have on the passing attack?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And you saw, like, look, man, Brady, it's not even domes. It's like good weather and bad weather too. Like,
right.
Brady went from Brady's passing statistics last season were absurd. And like, you can't tell me that part of that isn't obviously the receivers, by the way. Another point for loading up at wide receiver is that I was watching the NFC title game yesterday, and Tyler Johnson, the fifth wide receiver for Tampa, made like a humongous catch down the
back shoulder and everything. Yeah.
And not to mention Scotty Miller's plays in that game. But weather matters for sure. I mean, all these contextual things matter. Do they matter? Like, I would even say weather matters more in a DFS matchup than – maybe not more than defense, but like they should be considered on the same order of magnitude.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's why I think you should look at passing offenses and say, what has their situation been? And it's like, I love Matt Ryan. He's graded well for us through the years, but he's had a, with Julio and a dome, he's had a pretty favorable situation on the same.
Stafford has it. Although Stafford goes to a dome in LA, but like
he does. There's more domes around the NFL.
We're not talking about some like wounded, like brilliant player here. We're talking about a guy who's gotten a lot of coaches and offensive coordinators fired.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more domes around the NFL too, which is good for the NFL and explosive plays and all that stuff. So anyway, go check out Eric's work at the PFF Forecast, of course, over at pff.com. He's the heart and soul of all the numbers and grades and stats that are coming out in the fantasy world, and of course with every NFL team and all the college teams. So thanks, Eric, appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve, thanks for having me on. This is fun.
Yeah, buddy, we'll see you soon. All right, that was great from Eric Eager, co-host of the PFF Forecast. Again, be sure to go download and subscribe to wherever you're listening to our podcast and all of the great PFF podcasts. Mike Renner and Austin Gale. We're going to have Mike Renner on here on Thursday, by the way. So he's going to join me Thursday talking all things NFL draft, but really getting into some player evaluation stuff. Co-host of the 2-for-1 Drafts podcast. They're in the middle of rebranding. They're going to have a whole new name. It's going to be a whole new world over there. So go download and subscribe. Ian Hartit's doing a great job with all of our fantasy analysis. The PFF podcast mix is strong, so be sure to join all of those guys. And also, right now, this is what you need to do. PFF.com. PFF's 2021 Best Ball Draft Kit. Tiered rankings to projections to targetable stacks to the season's favorable matchups. It's all there. The only resource you'd ever need to wreak havoc across best ball formats all summer long. I love best ball. You just kind of set it and forget it. And PFF has the best data for all of that. So go check it out. PFF.com. It's our 2021 Best Ball Draft Kit. So that's it, Sam. I switched sides. I took your seat. We took over. Went full monologue style. We brought in Eric. Let's go to that wide shot. It's just me this week. Sam's on vacation, but doesn't matter. We carry on here, the PFF NFL Podcast. Be sure to continue to email us. It's NFLpodcast@pff.com. Love all of the email and the emails and interaction. You guys help fuel this show. So keep those emails coming in, and we'll be back here on Thursday with Mike Renner talking about player evaluation, 2022 NFL draft and his favorite drafts looking back in 2021. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. We'll see you guys Thursday.